Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Whether it was Westward Ho or the Beverly Hillbillies or just packing the moving van, Americans have always moved for jobs, for opportunity, for a change. But these days, not so much. We're staying put. That has reasons and implications. This hour on Point, why Americans aren't packing up and moving anymore. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the change? The lowest recorded rate of moving ever. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from South Bend, Indiana, is Abigail Wozniak, labor economist and professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. She's closely looking at migration between states and cities. Abigail Wozniak, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm looking at these new census numbers, and for as long as they have been keeping records, which is back to 1948, they have never seen a lower percentage of Americans moving in a given year than they saw between 2015 and 2016. It was 11.2% of us moved, they say. And that doesn't sound like nothing, but it's, what, half of what it was when they started keeping these figures back in 1948. They say we are now moving less often than Canadians, only a little bit more than Finns or Danes. That's getting way down there. This used to be kind of a regular American thing. What is going on?
Yeah, there's quite a lot going on. And what I wanted to, I think, start with is pointing out that some of those numbers really put together two different kinds of moving, and there's quite a lot going on in both of them.
Okay, take
really,
it apart.
Really, that's looking at kind of a change of residence. So were you in this location a year ago is the most common question that we have over a long period of time.
Yep.
And so that's going to change. That's going to kind of combine people who might have changed residence but stayed in the same area.
Okay.
Along with people who've made those kinds of moves that you were alluding to at the beginning. So the packing up and moving across country or packing the moving van, something that requires a real change of locale.
Okay.
And what we've been seeing in the data that we can look at kind of more recently is that there's been a big downtrend in both of those types of moving, both short distance and long distance.
All right.
But it's really the long distance one that's a bit more of a puzzle.
Because it's so a bigger drop or what? Is that what you mean?
It's a sizable drop. We see things that are kind of similar in terms of magnitude. So we're talking about, just like you said, about a 50% decline by some series. But when we try to explain it and look at kind of what's happening to different folks and is this coming from a certain part of the population or maybe a certain kind of behavior people might be engaging in, like homeownership, it's the long distance moving where we really struggle to explain it. And we see it affecting the most broad groups of people.
We should be clear, this Americans' readiness, willingness, capacity to move and move a long way within the country, it's a big country, was seen for a long time as very important to America's economic dynamism. We had what they called, what, labor mobility, right? People would move to where the jobs and the industries were booming, and that made our economy more fluid, more dynamic.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's certainly a big part of our self-image. I think there's a lot more work to be done to try to understand exactly how geographic mobility ties into that economic growth that we might have seen. But I think certainly no one would argue that the fact that California has been able to grow, you know, and is now a giant part of our overall national economy was very critical to the U.S.'s overall economic success over the 20th century. And that certainly wouldn't have happened without substantial amounts of migration.
You're a labor economist. Is this just because since the Great Recession, we've had fewer jobs available, so there's nothing to move to, or people afraid to leave their old job?
So this is certainly not just because of the Great Recession. And I kind of want to get that out there because what we thought when we started this is that it might be part of the Great Recession. And when we first kind of started to pull at this thread, I would say, we were really motivated by a lot of concerns that folks had that particularly the housing crash at the same time was going to make it hard for families to recover from the recession, that it was going to make it more difficult for them to pack up and find a place with better opportunity, and that was just overall going to magnify the impacts of the recession. We were worried about that. A lot of other people, I would say about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, were worried about that. When we started to dig into the data, though, we see that this decline in the long-distance moves is really just a straight-line trend back to, in our data at least, around 1970 or 1980, which is pretty consistent with the numbers that the census has put out as well. So around that kind of, not quite the middle, but starting the latter third of the 20th century, we seem to have kind of reached a peak in those types of long-distance moves, which are really the ones that get people to a new kind of labor market. And so what we kind of quickly concluded is that this is something that has to be bigger than a single recession, even as big as the Great Recession was.
You say that embedded in these numbers of very low, the lowest ever recorded rates or numbers of Americans moving, that there's a happy story here embedded in this and a sad story. What do you mean?
Right. There could be a happy story, and there could be a sad story. And I think a lot of our work going forward is going to be really to try to figure out for sure which one of these which one is going on. The happy story is that the reason people are moving less is that, you know, locations are just a better fit for folks. We've also tied this quite a bit to the labor market. So as a labor economist, I see this as very connected to people's ability to change jobs. And along with some colleagues and co-researchers at the Federal Reserve Board, we've done a lot of work kind of trying to understand how the labor market connects to this migration decline. Mm-hmm. So the happy story is, great, everyone's in a job that's a really good fit for them. They're in a location that's a good fit for them. They don't need to make these transitions. I at a conference had a really eminent economist say, you know, the only reason we're worried about this is because we're calling it mobility. If we were calling it turnover, we would be celebrating the fact that this was declining, because turnover sounds scary and bad and costly to people. So there is definitely a sense in which a transition could be a good thing or a transition could be a bad thing. So the happy story is, you know, maybe we're just finding these good fits for us at a faster rate. We're able to identify them more quickly out of the box, and so we don't have to make these transitions. The not-so-happy story is that somehow this kind of process of adjustment has gotten slowed down or become more difficult. And, you know, the word that economists would use for that is barriers. So there are barriers to labor mobility. There's barriers to adjustment. That means there's kind of some kind of cost or inhibiting factor that has become more significant over time. And so trying to tease those apart is what we've been actively working on.
I mean, maybe we don't want to judge this. Maybe it's not an act of judgment about whether it's good or bad, but it feels like a cultural change, at least from our self-image. Abigail Wozniak, please stand by there at Notre Dame. David Schleicher joins us as well right now from New Haven, Connecticut, professor at Yale Law School. You talked about barriers to mobility, and he's been writing a lot about that. Latest paper was Stuck in Place, Law and the Economic Consequences of Residential Stability. David Schleicher, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So if there are barriers now to moving, getting up and going, like what?
So I think you can break them into two types, barriers to entry and barriers to exit. And so the big question is, why aren't people moving to the hot job markets and why are they not leaving bad job markets? Okay. And in the barriers to entry bucket, the two biggest ones are limits on land use limits or limits on housing construction. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that boom areas had boom population. So Chicago goes from having 30,000 people in 1850 to 300,000 in 1870 to 1 million in 1890 to 2 million in 1910.
Exploding.
Enormous growth. Compare that to Silicon Valley over the last 20 years, our biggest boom area, grows by about 300,000 people. So it's barely at all.
Wow.
The reason is that they don't build enough houses. And you can see that people want to move there because the prices are so high.
Yep.
Shocking housing price increases. And this is a result of limits on housing construction, so laws that limit housing construction. Another limit on entry is occupational licensing rules. So about 23-24% of American work jobs require an occupational licensing from the state in order
to— For what kind of job? Like I'm an, I don't know, eye doctor or I'm a—
everything from eye doctors to hair braiders
okay.
to interior interior designers to lawyers like me. Okay. And so these are given by states, and frequently they're not transferable across states. And this makes it very hard to if you're licensed in one state or unlicensed in one state that want to move to a state that has a
license. Is there more licensing – are there more licensing barriers today than there were in, I don't know, the late 1970s?
It's blown up. So it went from about 5% of jobs in 1950 to about 25% of jobs now, 24% now. And same thing's true for land use. Land use restrictions had no effect on regional housing prices in 1970. And today, they have a very, very large effect. And you can see this directly affecting moves. So two Harvard economists have found that pre-1970, the average GDP per state per capita GDP per state was converging because poor people would move to richer areas and so the per capita. And starting in 1970, that slows, and it only slows for places that have high land use restrictions. So these two things are extremely inhibiting entry. On the other side, we've got limits on exit. So these are kind of a more varied set of things, but differences in public benefit eligibility. So if you're if you can get Medicaid where you are, but where you'd move to, Medicaid isn't available, that will inhibit moving. About 13% of American workers are public employees, and for public employees, moving until before your pension vests is a really big problem. Homeownership subsidies. So we know that areas with high homeownership, ceteris paribus, have all else equal, have a high unemployment rate. And this is possibly because of house lock. People can't move because they can't sell their house.
House locks, barriers to entry into new communities, barriers to exit from where people are now. There's a lot to look at here. We're going to dive right on in. David Schleicher at Yale Law School, please stand by there in New Haven. Abigail Wozniak in South Bend, Indiana from Notre Dame, please stand by as well. We're looking at Americans not packing up and moving like they used to. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Oh, you know it, baby. And I know it too, baby. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Americans not packing up and moving like they used to, hunkering down, digging in, staying put. We've got the lowest rate of Americans moving ever since we've kept track, half the rate today that it was in 1948, and it's been kind of a steady line in that direction. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Why aren't we moving like we did? Are the opportunities just not out there? Can you not sell the house? Are we more invested in family and friends, local routines? Do you feel like you don't have the financial cushion to hit the road, make a move, or you're just not interested anymore? Are we changing somehow there as a culture? Abigail Wozniak is with us from Notre Dame. David Schleicher from Yale Law School. They're both looking at this from different angles. William Fry joins us in a moment to think about the culture, some of the cultural reasons that might be behind all this. Of course, the tradition and a sort of American self-understanding of as people who move goes back a long way. Sometimes it was exciting. Sometimes it was just rough. Here's a little bit from The Grapes of Wrath, 1940, the film adaptation of Steinbeck. The Jodes are packing up and heading out from Dust Bowl, Oklahoma, to California in the 1930s. And Jim Casey, played by John Carradine, stops by to see them off and then tries to get a ride out west, too.
Goodbye. Good luck.
Hold it, Al! Ain't you going with us?
I'd like to. There's something going on out there in the West, and I'd like to try and learn what it is. If you feel you got the room.
Plenty of room.
Get on.
Get on, Dave. There I go, Al.
Over here.
California, here we come.
California, here we come. That's then. Abigail, David, lots of callers for the two of you. Let me go to Elizabeth in Phillip, South Dakota. Elizabeth, thank you for calling. You are on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your experience? What's your story, Elizabeth?
Well, my husband and I have moved all over the country several times.
Why? And what's your business, or what's taking you around?
My husband's in the National Park Service, and pursuing his career means transferring. Yes. You have to move up onwards if you want to move upwards.
Okay, National Park Service. Is he still tweeting?
Yes, he is.
Okay. So are you still moving, or what's the story now?
Well, our last move was 2 years ago from Georgia to South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I don't see us moving anytime soon.
Why not?
He's happy. Well, he's happy with his job. We have a son who is about to start high school next school year. It's kind of hard with children to uproot them frequently.
Yep.
And in addition to that, we can't sell our house in Georgia. It's not selling. It's been on the market for over 2 years.
Maybe you're asking too much money, Elizabeth.
I've dropped it to under market value.
Wow. And what if he gets another promotion? Then would you go? Or is it the Georgia thing still around your neck, or the son in high school is enough to make you just stay put?
Well, I think it would depend on the particular job, if it were good enough. But he's high enough that he's already a park superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on would need another fairly big deal. I have a job that I'm happy at now. Every time we move, I have to reinvent my career.
Yeah.
So it gets hard to move. But, again, we've moved several times all over. We enjoy the adventure of the next new place.
Hey, that two-income family piece comes in here, too, and I know that's a complicating factor. Best to your husband and the National Park Service. They've been great lately, and we appreciate your story, Elizabeth. Let me get a couple more, and I'll take it to Abigail and David. Tony in Boston. Tony, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm interested that most of your guests and yourself seem very concerned about the lack of long distance mobility, and I see it as a huge plus. I remember in the 80s when families started to say to their husbands who would get a promotion that required moving across the country, no, sweetie, we're going to stay here. We
mm-hmm.
do not want to move with you. I saw, you know, the 50s where mobility was huge, back and forth, uprooting families, and then Levittown and the isolation of families.
Yes.
Had no grandparents. The wives had, at that point, not many jobs. And they were stuck, and they became, a lot of them, alcoholics out there in the suburbs
mm-hmm.
without help. And I just see it as a huge plus that people have said, no, we're not moving across country to a better job. I think companies need to realize that they need to be where the workers are, because tearing families apart from their roots, from the help that they have raising children, and the United States is already low on the childbearing side.
Child care so, part. And Yeah. Tony, I absolutely hear you. And, of course, you can go either way. It's just really interesting to think of a country that has carved its mobility in half. That's a cultural change. Abigail Wozniak, do you see a qualitative benefit to people's lives in not being as mobile as Americans once were? Tony does.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely reason to think that there are social benefits that would come from this. We have a lot of historical evidence that suggests that communities with kind of lower mobility rates are ones that can sometimes invest more deeply in public goods, things like schools and parks, but also just that kind of, sort of intangible community that Tony was mentioning. I think for an economist,
or very tangible
though,
sometimes, if it's
or
grandma taking care of the kids. Yeah,
exactly. But economists think of my mobility as representing choice. And a concern that arises is whether these declines that we're seeing are coming out of a narrowing of the choice set, or I think, like Tony was envisioning, this is kind of workers actively saying this isn't something we want and making an active choice to not engage in this. And I think unfortunately, a lot of the evidence that we see is pointing in the direction that choices have kind of narrowed and somehow these transitions have become harder, not necessarily because it's folks actively saying that's something they would not prefer, although I think it's definitely something to keep on the table and keep in mind as something we should be looking more closely at.
We've got listeners responding on Facebook and Twitter to the labor market. Marie writes to us, "We're not moving because wages aren't moving. A small pay increase might get me to a new job, but not a new state." We can hear that. And then here's another from Mari. He says, labor market? What labor market? People are not moving as much because it's expensive and there's really no place left to go in America where wages are equivalent to living costs. Get a better job, pay higher housing costs. Pretty simple. That kind of equation. I mean, David was talking about it, Abigail, but just try moving to Silicon Valley for a better job. You better have a heck of a good job to afford anything there.
Absolutely. And I completely want to underscore that and tie that to, I think, what I was able to say a little bit earlier, which is that we really see this as coming strongly out of the labor market. I've had a chance to dig into some of the things that David has looked at, and I think those are certainly important trends. But what we're seeing in our data is that there's something going on in the way that workers and firms make these transitions and new hires. And it's pointing to something that says these kinds of transitions have just become harder and more difficult and maybe more fraught. And so both workers and firms seem to be less willing to do them. So one thing we've explored in our work is how the decline in mobility tracks with other kinds of labor market transitions. So people just changing employers, people changing industry, or people changing occupations, those have all gone down since the 1970s at least. And so it tracks pretty well this decline in migration. So our conclusion is really that there's something about the labor market that is kind of slowing all those transitions down. And the result is that we also see people less able to make these geographic moves.
Kevin writes to us on Twitter, says, look, 7 in 10 Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. Most places need first, last, and security deposit to rent. There's your answer. Dollars. He wants a dollar sign. David, flesh the picture on out for us.
So I think more than the general trend, the most concerning part about declining mobility is declining mobility away from severely economically declining areas and then declining mobility to growing areas.
In other words, your area is in a real pothole,
right,
and you just don't get out of it, can't.
Right. So that there's a lot of work that shows that places that really got socked by trade, the unemployment lingered for long periods of time rather than people leaving. And so at the aggregate level, we can have one story, but it's a much harder story to tell about why people aren't leaving places where the unemployment rate is 20-25%. And the the social stories kind of tell us things about the aggregate story, but when you start seeing real privation, it's the social stories don't get us all the way there. And I think you need to start looking at that legal and social and political and economic impediments.
So give us more. Give us more. What about housing markets or you name it?
So, I mean, I think one thing that to look for is that this is also likely to get worse rather than better. If we see interest rate increases, there'll be a lot of people who have their mortgage at a low rate, but when they sell, so that they can't take it with them. And so I actually think this trend's going to get worse rather than better, assuming we see increased interest rates. And so I don't know what you're looking for. Whether you're looking for solutions, which is I give kind of a shruggy face, there are a whole bunch of policy problems, and you could reverse those policies, though that would take a lot. And there's a lot of reasons why that doesn't happen. They're largely created by state and local governments who have a great deal of incentive to care about stability, but not so much incentive to care about broader economic trends like the way mobility improves monetary policy.
What about our caller Tony, who says, look, this isn't something to bemoan. This is something to celebrate. People stay nearer family. They have more continuity and more stability in their lives. It's a positive.
That's a totally fine story for the general case, but not really for the specific case of really economically declining places, right? So if you see people remaining in places that have extremely high unemployment, we can think of that as a problem. It costs the federal government, it costs state governments a lot of money. Further, we have all sorts of national policies that are premised on mobility. So the dollar is the one currency in the United States, and the Federal Reserve has to make monetary policy that works for Detroit and Silicon Valley. And if unemployment is high in one place and low in another place, that job gets really hard. Similarly, social welfare spending We rely on states and localities to do a great deal of it. And that works if poor people follow rich people, right? So that if the places that have rich people can tax them to pay for redistribution to poor people who are there also. But if we have places that don't have rich people or don't have working people, but have a very, very large number of poor people, local contributions to redistributive spending will fall substantially. And so these are – we have institutions that are built up around the story of big mobility or we can think about either changing those. I mean, idea of creating two separate dollars across the United States seems sort of crazy. Or we can attempt to increase mobility. But there's a deep conflict between our national economic institutions and our declining mobility.
I mean, Abigail, our listeners are really pounding on this theme that they might like to move, but they just can't. They don't have the dough. Hector says it's too expensive. Trudy says, I'd love to move. Can't afford it. Being stuck sucks. She says, Bear says, poor and broke, maybe, for the reason Kimberly says, why aren't we moving? Because we are broke. What part of the middle class is being the middle class being eradicated by the elite class, don't you understand?
Right. So I am really excited to hear from your listeners because I often get, when I talk to people about this, a kind of quizzical look of how can this possibly be the case? Of course, we're moving more. You know, life feels crazy. Things are hectic. We must be moving more, right? And actually, the data say the complete opposite. And I'm so glad to hear from folks who are really kind of understanding this on the ground.
They're not happy about it. They're not glad.
They're not happy about it. I think they're not happy about it. And exactly, kind of as I was mentioning, the evidence we have suggests that this is kind of a constraining situation. This is not the result of in all cases anyway, this is not the result of lots of folks saying, you know what, I'm going to make an active choice to stay. This is, I think the evidence suggests, a result of that choice set narrowing. That's a very economist way of putting it, but I think it means the same thing to lots of people. You just have fewer options. Certainly, income and savings are going to make sense as a big part of this. One of the things I was most surprised about, we spent a lot of time looking at whether this decline in labor market turnover and long distance moving, whether that was coming from this rise in inequality that has also been going on since the 1970s. And I at least had kind of a strong suspicion that, you know, this might be part of the story.
You mean like
definitely,
it's a privilege
like a lot of the listeners
of the,
are saying.
Privilege exactly. Of the affluent to move these days?
What we were surprised to find is that states that had the biggest rises in inequality actually had the smaller declines in mobility.
Okay.
I think that generated some mobility that people didn't want to engage in. They were displaced.
Yep.
But it tells us that actually without this rise in inequality, we would have seen an even bigger decline in mobility than we have seen. So we definitely, I think, have to be looking to wages and to kind of savings. But I think there's, again, something bigger going on about just how do workers search for those jobs? How do employers search for them? What makes that kind of relationship form? And what might have become more difficult about that?
Terry in Rogers, Arkansas. Terry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I know you might have maybe realized or overlooked that the mass incarceration might have an effect on it. People spending decades on parole and on probation restricts their loved ones from moving out of state. But myself, I grew up moving all over the country, and I truly hated that. So. For my kids, I decided to stay in place.
I mean, good for you, but you're saying also mass incarceration, prison, probation, that can be a real kind of ball and chain. If people did want to move, they just couldn't, Terry.
That's right.
Well,
and that interacts with other parts of the economy, right? So,
Terry, thanks, David. Yeah,
sorry. If you're on parole frequently, you can't get an occupational license, as I mentioned, and so these things interact with one another and kind of gum up the economy across a huge number of dimensions. But I think that's a great point.
Are we on lockdown in some way, David?
Lockdown, I think, might be a little strong. It's certainly the case that across a bunch of dimensions, we've created things that gunk up mobility, both across firms and across places.
We'll look at that with demographer William Fry when we return. David Schleicher at Yale Law School, Abigail Wozniak at Notre Dame. Please stand by. We are talking this hour, and it is interesting, all the layers, all the of this onion about Americans not packing up and moving like they used to. Take it away, Willie Nelson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It's on the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again. And I can't wait to get on the road again.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Americans not packing up and moving like they used to. The latest numbers out show the rate the lowest ever since statistics have been kept starting in 1948, about half the rate of moves today that we had then. Way down there, about 1 in 10 who would move in a given year. And at one time, Americans moved in much greater numbers than that. Abigail Wozniak is with us from Notre Dame, David Schleicher from Yale Law School. William Fry joins us in just a moment for Demographer's View. You can join us as well. Why do you think Americans aren't moving so much anymore? And is it a problem or not? Here's a little CBS News interview. And last month, Kate Downing, corporate attorney, lives in Silicon Valley, said the housing market in that sort of boom zone is so expensive that average American workers can't afford to live there and can't afford, like she can very often, to move.
The people we should feel sorry for are the people who can't do that. What are you going to tell the people who are our cooks, our cops, our teachers, our nurses? Those are people you don't want to lose. You can lose some more. You can't lose the people who are the backbone of your city.
Demographer William Fry joins us right now from Washington, fellow with the Brookings Institution. Been listening and thinking about this. Bill Fry, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, I'm pleased to be with all of you. This is a great topic. I'm happy to be part of it.
Expand on it from a demographer's point of view. Are we just changing? Are the kinds of people who move or don't move changing or, moving the needle on this? What's going on from your view, Bill?
Well, I think there's a long-term perspective and then a shorter-term perspective. The longer-term perspective, I think we've been discussing with the work of Abigail and David about all of the factors, with the labor market, with some of the barriers to migration. There's some demographic aspects to the aging of the population and so forth. But the shorter term, and this has really happened since about 2007, it's true it's been this long-term decline in migration, but it's taken a steeper bent since that 2007 period. And I wouldn't underestimate, at least for this last several years, the impact of the Great Recession and particularly its impact on the millennial generation. About two-thirds of all moves, whether they're local moves or whether they're long-distance moves, are taken by people under age 35 and their children. And a prime number, a prime group moving into that age group now are the famous millennials. They're not all living in their parents' basements, but many more of them are than other young adults have earlier. I mean, we've all seen the stories about them delaying marriage, delaying childbearing, delaying get on career tracks. And a lot of that also has to do with lower mobility. And I think that, this is something is it going to be a long-term phenomenon for younger people going forward? Do they like staying put? Do they like living in cities? Do they like, putting their life on hold a while? Or is it something that when the economy picks up just a little bit, at least the next generation of young adults will move to a little bit more like the mobility rates of the 1990s, never back to the 1950s, with really high migration rates, but maybe back to the 1990s rather than what we have now. So I think that's a real issue to look at, and it's one that may have longer-term implications. After all, many of them don't have cars. Many of them take jobs that they can telecommute. Many of them are in the so-called gig economy, may not be concerned about those long-term benefits. They may not be available to them. They switch around jobs. Is this a long-term trend? And that'll affect mobility as well.
You know, I've got a listener here writing to us saying he wonders if Americans are just less curious or kind of adventurous than they used to be. Also asks, is there a perception or maybe reality that things aren't as different, you know, from one part of the country to another these days? So what does it matter?
I can respond to that just a little bit. I mean, before the recession took place, there was a much bigger movement from the Snowbelt states to the Sunbelt states. That was put almost on hold, not quite on hold. But now that the economy is doing a little bit better again, there is that movement. So what I'm talking about here is not so much the frequency of movement, but the direction and destinations of people who do move. And that does respond a lot to what's going on, whether it's the economy, whether it's something that it's amenities for retirees or whatever it is. We did see it over the course of the recession and then coming back again. Again, not just migration rates, but the parts of the country that are now sort of reviving, getting those flows into them again. So I think that's some of a response to what she says.
Let's go to Chris in Charleston, South Carolina. Chris, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes. And I am a 26-year-old millennial, as part of this discussion that I can provide some input into.
Great. Yep. So are you moving or not moving, Chris? What's up?
I'm not moving as much as I'd like to. Like I said, I'm 26. I'm young. I have that energy. I studied abroad 3 times in college. I have that quote-unquote travel bug, and I don't own a house, and I don't have kids, so what's actually preventing me from moving? That's the question.
What's the answer?
I don't know. My wife and I want to live somewhere new every 2 to 3 years, and she keeps me in check when I start getting too comfortable. But I think there is a distinction between vacationing and mobility. I kind of draw that line. I live by the motto, my life is better than your vacation, and I would honestly rather drive somewhere new, relatively local every weekend, rather than fly and have 2 to 3 vacations a year and not enjoy the day-to-day.
When it comes to moving, are you limited by financial constraints, Chris?
Yes, very much. I have student loans, but I'm going to enjoy my local surroundings instead of putting that upfront bill of uprooting. I know we've mentioned job security. I live in the town where I graduated. I'm just paying those loans and enjoying what I can while I'm around here.
Chris, you've got it. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. David Schleicher, there, right there, though, is the sound of what sounds like a different American attitude. You know, it's tough. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to enjoy it right here. That's not the Jobs heading out in their truck for California.
Yeah, there's two things that are interesting. It's completely plausible that there have been changed tastes. And so, I mean, it's a little bit hard to tell. On the other hand, those changed tastes could be rationalizations of economic situations. So it's kind of hard to untangle that. Notably, I mean, the thing that I think is interesting is that this is a situation that he's an interesting story. He seems like he does have some choice and is choosing to stay, seems like that's a good thing, right? So people's tastes should be met. And so I don't think we should push mobility for the sake of mobility. I think we should try to limit, remove impediments to mobility if that's interfering with people's opportunities to advance.
Rebecca in Baltimore. Rebecca, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would be curious to hear any comments on perhaps the effect of the internet and people working remotely and how that's had an impact on the decline, and also the what effect women working outside of the home has had, perhaps them wanting to stay closer to extended family for support.
Yeah, both good questions. Abigail, how about it? Internet, who needs to move when you can just, you know, type in a different web address? And what about women working and support networks?
Yeah, those are great questions. They're actually things that we looked at pretty early on in this project. And I think I have some numbers that are maybe a little surprising because we always think of the dual career households as maybe something that complicates this. But between 1980 and the later 2000s, so 2010, in 1980, the moving rate of households where both spouses were working was 2.8. For households where one spouse was working, it was 2.9. And then by 2010, those numbers had dropped to 1.5 and 1.8. So both of them fell, again, by close to that 50% number. When we've tried to look at this, we find that the two-career households are really not a big part of the story. It's certainly more common than it was, say, in the 1960s. Can't explain a lot of what's happened since 1980. And the other thing I like to point out to people is that, you know, for most dual-career couples, they're in big jobs, jobs that we have lots of. They're not doing something super hyper specialized. So if one labor market is good for one of them, it's probably good for both of them. And that's what I think resolves some of that kind of puzzle about, well, wouldn't it be harder for two people to move than one? In a lot of these families, if it's a good idea for one of them to move, it's a good idea for both of them to move.
But it did seem on the face of it, mm-hmm. it would seem like you've got to arrange two jobs in the new location. That's twice as hard as just arranging one new job in the new location. Or am I misreading it?
Yeah, no, I think what I'm saying is if it's a poor location, you're in one of those declining markets that David's been talking about, mm-hmm. And you want to move to a market that's growing faster with more opportunity, for most families with two workers, that second market is going to be better for both of them.
Okay.
So while it's true you do have to kind of make two new job matches, I think that resolves some of that puzzle for people. I think people are sometimes surprised to see that the decline in migration was just as big for two yeah. career families as it was for one career family.
And telecommuting?
Yeah, telecommuting is definitely much more common than it was in 1970 or 1980, in that, you know, we have an increase over basically a zero base. So those numbers, you know, the percent increase is always going to be really big. But the reality is a very small number of workers are engaging in that. It's definitely becoming more common in certain occupations. But again, we can measure this, and it's just not a big enough number to explain this trend. That really would be the tail wagging the dog in this situation, and that's not what we see happening here.
Bill Fry, is there a red state, blue state element to this, that people stay within a certain country? We hear all about the great sorting of Americans into communities of like-minded or like individuals. Are people wanting to stay in their stream?
Well, you know, there have been studies that tried to show this is occurring. I think if you look at most of the research on long-distance migration, it has a lot to do with the labor market forces. In other words, if you're going to a place that has a lot of jobs, you're not going to be worried so much if it's a red state or a blue state. Mm-hmm. At the local level, it may make a little more sense if you're going to choose what neighborhood you're going to move to. But I sort of look at it this way, that you tend to choose a neighborhood that have people with the same kind of socioeconomic characteristics that you do, whatever it is, people with kids, people with certain income, whatever that is. And that maybe determines to some degree what their political views are. Not the other way around. You don't look at a place that, well, I want all my neighbors to vote for so-and-so. I think that's it. The causality, I think, may go the other way.
Peter, in tops of – oh, sorry, David. Please.
Sorry. The one thing I'd add, though, is that in general, blue state metros have restricted housing construction a little more, mm-hmm. substantially more than ones in the South and West in kind of red states. And so we may see – it's not a sorting mechanism among people wanting to live with yep. like-minded people, but it is the case that some kind of Democratic-controlled areas have more substantially restricted housing construction.
Mm. Peter in Topsom, Maine. Peter, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. I am a bankruptcy trustee up here, and I see a large number of mortgage loan modifications that are issued either before a bankruptcy is filed, during a bankruptcy, or after a bankruptcy, the result of which is that folks end up with a huge debt against their property that is not being amortizing, and especially people who have a past history of financial troubles who used to be very mobile
yep.
now find themselves locked in to their present location forever and ever and ever because of the mortgage loan modification structures.
And Peter, do you see that working its way out as we've come further out of the Great Recession, or it's baked in the cake under the covers there, to mix 16 metaphors?
I predict that there will be an echo of Chapter 7 filings in 5 to 10 years of the people that have been filing, have been obtaining the loan modifications when oh. they try to move and go somewhere where the jobs are.
Yeah, there's another kind of lockdown right there. We don't want to discount at all. Peter, I appreciate your call from Maine. Let's go to Savannah, Georgia. Omar, you're on.
Hello. I'd just like to make a couple of observations. The switch from agrarian to urban life at the last century,
yep,
really accelerated the movement across the country. But there is a group of people that migrate annually all over the country for agriculture, manufacturing, and construction, and that is out of country workers, and they're highly dynamic. Some of the families have been doing it for years. So I wonder if that enters into anybody's observation.
That's interesting. Omar, thanks. Abigail, is it possible that we have foreign workers doing the moving while Americans sit tight?
Yeah, again, that's a great question and something that we wondered about. We, again, just like with the two career families, see a big decline in the mobility rates of foreign-born workers once they're already here. Hmm. And then we've done some analysis where we try to just control for how many foreign workers are coming in or which states are getting the most of them. And again, it's contributing a bit, kind of the way you think it would. But we still see something bigger going on.
Wow, even the foreigners not moving as much. One more. Zach,
yeah.
Zach, Tampa, Florida. Take us home, Zach. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. I'm actually from the Rust Belt in Youngstown, Ohio, and I moved down to Tampa, Florida for this exact reason about most of the calls that you're talking about. I am a millennial. I am 26.
Yep.
I've been able to find better work here in Tampa, Florida than almost any of my former college classmates. They're all struggling working 2 to 3 jobs. I didn't think the moving was that hard of a struggle, as the majority of your previous callers have said. But once we've gotten down here, I mean, we've now bought a house. We've now, you know, are moving into starting a family. And I don't think it's as hard hitting to the millennials as a lot of people are saying. The student loans are obviously there, but I think it's the management that a lot of people are really having the struggle with.
So what do you say to your age cohort who may be working those 3 jobs and just not even thinking about moving, Zach? Are you a, you know, come on in, the water's fine guy?
I definitely am. I think a majority of people in my generation are having a hard time just budgeting, let alone working right. So if they would actually budget what they needed to do, they could make that big move that they've always dreamed of instead of, you know, living the rest of their life in somewhere that they didn't want to live anyways.
Zach, living the life in Tampa, Florida. Zach, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. David Schleicher, do you see us moving out of this? Or, you know, it's been a straight line, Abigail says, since the late 1970s. Are we just a less mobile nation? Maybe not the nation on the move.
I think it's going to get worse. I think that all of the legal policy trends that I've talked about are getting worse over time. I don't see any particular reason for the forces that Abigail's talking about to change. I mean, maybe they will. Who knows? But I think that at least in the short to medium – and then the thing I mentioned about interest rates, in the short to medium term, I suspect this problem will get worse, and it's going to result in even greater amounts of regional inequality.
Donald Trump says he wants to blow up regulation. Maybe he'll change things.
Who knows? Can never predict things with him.
Who knows? Well, it's really interesting to see such a kind of fundamental piece of America's self-identity in motion here and a downward trend on people moving. David Schleicher at Yale Law School, thank you very much for being with us today for your insights. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bill Fry, William Fry at the Brookings Institution, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much, Bill.
Happy to be here.
And Abigail Wozniak at Notre Dame, joining us from South Bend, Indiana. Thank you very much, Abigail, for being here.
Thanks to you and your listeners.
Listeners, off we go, or maybe we don't. Thanks for joining us wherever you are. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.